Welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. My name's Emily Boddy, and each week we're bringing you interviews with our members, guests and colleagues from the global underwater technology community. Podcast 46, 28th of January, 2021. In this episode, SUT Council member Andrew Connolly speaks with Marco Gillison, Global UXO Marine Risk Mitigation Director and Offshore Wind Site Appraisal and Design Array Solution Owner at Fugro. Marco talks about UXO risk mitigation and the processes involved to deal with UXO issues that are experienced by different markets around the globe.
Welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast. My guest today is Marco Gillison from Fugro, and he's going to talk to us today about UXO risk mitigation. But before we start talking about that, Marco, please introduce yourself by telling us who you are, where did you train, and how did you get to the point you are at today?
Thank you very much. Hi, my name is Marco Gillison. I'm the Global UXO Solution Director for Fugro, based in the Netherlands. Outside of my UXO Solution Director role, I also look after the site appraisal and array design as solution owner in the offshore wind part of our Fugro's business. I originally trained as a land surveyor in South Africa, and after about 8 years of private practice and working with the South African government surveying department, I moved into the marine world and primarily geophysics, subsea and hydrographic space. I have over 22 years experience in that industry, primarily within Africa, but also globally, the vast majority of which has been with Fugro.
So speaking about UXO mitigation or UXO risk mitigation, which I'm sure you elaborate on the term as we have this discussion, what's the extent of the UXO problem globally?
It is a global problem, and I'm pleased to use the word globally. Very often it's seen as a purely European-focused issue post-World War I, World War II, but it is global. And to give you an idea of the extent of that, and bear in mind here, we're not talking only unexploded ordnance from wars and conflict situations, but also, and the largest part, from dumped munitions in our marine environment. For many years, it was out of sight, out of mind, and that's how they disposed of ordnance when it came to the end of its life. So it's not just about wars, it's about dumping as well. But to give you a real tangible, there's estimated to be almost 1.3 million tons of ordnance in the world's marine environment. And that's spread globally. Just about every country has a dumping site. If they have a military, they have a dumping site. And so it's a global issue. 1.3 million tons is quite difficult to comprehend in terms of how big is that. But quick calculation I did a couple of weeks back. If you had to take the average weight and size of a UXO and work it out, and you place them end to end, it's a line of dumped munitions in the oceans, which would stretch from Amsterdam to Hong Kong. So an 11-hour flight, roughly, of Boeing, to fly over all the ordnance that's currently sitting in our oceans around the world. And that just puts it into perspective of just how much is there and how much has been dumped and the extent of the problem.
Yeah, that's quite something. That's a lot more than I would expect. And in my limited knowledge of it is based on, you know, what would probably be found in the North Sea or around UK waters through World War dumping. But yeah, that's impressive to think that it's the scale of it.
Yeah, agreed. As I mentioned earlier, it's been a dump in the oceans. Forget about it. And there was a lot of that done after World War One and particularly World War Two. And in those days, it wasn't really considered what the implications were in years to come. And of course, that's with the increase in marine developments and interactions with the marine environment through primarily the offshore wind of late, but also historically through port and infrastructure development, oil and gas projects. Suddenly, these dumped munitions or munitions that are remnants of war and battles are a real threat to these developments and need to be considered on a global scale on just about every marine project. Added to which, there's an increasing pollutant risk and threat, and we're seeing that coming through in some of the trace chemicals that are being seen in, for instance, fish stocks in some parts of the world where we're starting to see traces of arsenic, for instance, from UXOs that are leaking into the water, into the system. Admittedly, not at levels mm-hmm. that are a risk to humans at this stage, but there's definitely a spike over the last 10 years, and there's been a number of papers issued and academic papers issued around this topic. And of course, there's increasing human impact as these UXOs degrade and break open. A lot of the chemicals within them, beyond leaking into our marine environment, are also starting to interact with humans. So the equipment we place in the seabeds, for instance, get contaminated by the remnants of, for instance, chemical weapons and the contents of the UXOs themselves. but they're also starting to wash up on the beaches. And there's been numerous cases over the last few years of people on the beaches picking up, for instance, phosphorus that comes from some of the UXOs and injuring themselves. It's not only a risk for development, but it's also a risk just for the use of our oceans and shoreline.
You mentioned specifically about World War One and World War Two. Is it typically a historic thing, or is there ongoing dumping? Is it a renewed problem, or is it something that it could be cleared, but is there renewed munitions dumping in the world?
There is, and it varies from region to the world and different jurisdictions and countries, but dumping does continue. As I said, most countries with a maritime coastline and a military of some description has had a dumping site. That continues around the world. But I think there is an increased focus on proper disposal of that in many countries, and certainly the more developed countries are doing it in a better way than they were perhaps 20, 30 years ago. But it's still there. It's still ongoing and it's still happening.
What motivates you to work in this industry?
For me, what's important and interesting around this industry and what motivates and drives our team is really around our philosophy, our company philosophy of creating a safe and livable world. We believe that the UXO risk mitigation business lends directly into that and helps us deliver on our company mantra and philosophy.
So can you describe to our audience what's involved, processes, activities in UXO risk mitigation?
Sure, absolutely. There's four key steps in this process. The ultimate goal is to reach a situation which we typically refer to in industry as an ALARP situation, so as low as reasonably possible. So that's not to say when an area has been risk mitigated, there are no UXO threats. But what it does say is we've done everything that's feasibly possible within the bounds of technology, process, and of course cost to reduce the risk to a level that's acceptable for the particular operation that's going to happen in that area, or development that's going to happen in that area. So the four steps typically starts off with a desktop historical study, and that's typically driven by a realization from a client, a contractor, or someone within the region that there is a risk to the activity that's about to commence. In order to quantify that and match that against the type of work that we're undertaking, a desktop historical study is undertaken. And at that point, there may be no further risk, and the process is considered risk mitigated at that point. But very often, and most often, there's a follow-on phase needed, which is the second phase, the survey phase. And this is really your traditional geophysical type sensors, where we map and survey an area both on the seabed and under the seabed to try and get a sense of what potential UXO may be there and create a sort of target list that is then used in the third phase, which is the identification process, in order to go with various types of subsea equipment, most typically an ROV, and look at these targets that were identified and quantify whether they are in fact UXO or they are debris of some description, old anchors or cables, etc., that match the content or ferrous content or the dimensions of typical UXO. And at that point, there may be a percentage that turn out to indeed be UXO. And then we step into the fourth phase, which is the disposal or clearance process. And that's either through disposing of the targets or what we typically call a lift and shift type operation, where we move it out of the area of operations and interest. And this is normally the primary approach taken, is to reroute and trying to work around it. And which of those are adopted in that fourth phase is really dependent on the type of development and various other stakeholder requirements around the UXOs that are confirmed and located.
So as you describe, it's risk mitigation, not necessarily removal or, you know, disposing of the ordnance. There's other ways of doing it, either rerouting past it or moving the ordnance to another location.
Indeed. And that's really driven by where you are, the particular lay of the land, so to speak, and the requirements of the stakeholders and the advice, of course, from somebody like ourselves as to how best to deal with the particular confirmed UXOs. The type also plays into it. So if it's, you know, certain UXOs are more volatile and you can't move them and you have to dispose of them in situ, others it's not the case. And you may then choose a lift and shift type of operation if the local conditions allow it.
Any interesting details of specific projects that you can share with the audience?
Yeah, we've done several, some fairly complex UXO projects. A lot of these have been really around Europe. We've done projects in, for instance, Taiwan, the Americas, parts of the Middle East where we're busy at the moment. But yeah, most of them around at this stage have really been around the North Sea. We've had some interesting projects. I mean, beyond the typical UXO, we've found, for instance, parts of aeroplanes that have, fighter planes that have been shot down on a recent project. We found, for instance, the tailpiece of a bomber, American bomber, and we were able to trace exactly the exact bomber from records and, in fact, retrieve the tailpiece, and it's in the process of being returned to the particular American squadron to which it originally belonged. So, yeah, some interesting finds and a nice way to bring history and those that enjoy history and the study of it is something tangible through finding the tailpiece of this bomber, American bomber.
Yeah, I would imagine through any site survey that you would do as part of the operation, you're going to come across some interesting things. I mean, it's you know, munitions dumping historically, but flight paths for aircraft and vessels, yeah, you would find some interesting things. So which type of organizations would engage your services?
Most typically, it's the wind farm developers and operators. And we're seeing particularly the more established, longer established ones. Those are the ones that are really the earliest, the majority of their requirement. Outside of that, we also engage quite heavily with EPCI contractors, so the contractors that would be involved in the construction of the wind farms themselves. They have obviously a particular interest in ensuring the safety of the equipment and the operations that they're undertaking. And in certain countries and certain locations, of course, the local government or regional authorities are also our client base. But what, interesting, what we're also seeing is as the offshore wind is driving this market, we're seeing increasingly greater due diligence and requirements from the oil and gas industry, for instance. And also the ports and infrastructure is increasingly becoming a client base for us, particularly when it comes to areas of disposal, which are quite often not far from port developments. And historically, nobody really thought about the port expansions and the requirements of where the disposal site is in relation to that. So it's also an increasing client base and market for us.
Yeah, I was going to ask if the offshore renewables boom in construction has really changed your industry.
It has, and it's developing the industry. I mean, the UXO risk mitigation is not new. It's been around for, well, ever since wars have been there, and this problem has had to be dealt with. But I think what the offshore industry has done is created a market and a size of market where a lot more time and effort can be spent on R&D and focusing on tailoring the particular technologies and tools that we would use in typical marine type of surveys and investigation type projects. But now having the time and the opportunity to develop those further to optimize them for the UXO business, and the offshore wind has created that opportunity and requirement.
As you find the industry moving on and advancing and the market moving on, is there an evolution in technologies that you make use of to make things more precise or maybe make things more efficient through operations?
Yes, I think so. And it links a little bit back to what I said earlier about tailoring the tools and the equipment and making them more efficient more highly accurate for the particular requirements of UXO. Identification. We still see across the industry and all operators in this industry, there are a lot of false positives, which we end up chasing. By false positives, I mean targets that have been identified from the survey phase, but in the end turn out not to be UXOs and are simply other kinds of man-made debris that match the specifications of a typical UXO, so anchors and the like. So because of that, you end up spending a lot of time in your identification phase chasing essentially items that aren't UXO. And if you look at an average globally of every 100 targets that are identified and need investigation, probably only around 2-5% end up actually being UXO in the end. So a lot of time is spent removing debris and chasing items that aren't UXOs. So the whole technology around that and the equipment that's used needs to evolve and develop to a point where that number is becoming a lot closer. And ideally, in an ideal world, you want to end up in a situation where you have 10 targets on your target list and all 10 are known UXOs confirmed, and they are exactly what type they are before you then go and identify them with most typically an ROV. Of course, we'll never get there, but that's the kind of the holy grail that we work towards and really moving the needle from 2-5% to whatever number we can get it to. Our philosophy a little bit around that is really a lot of focus in the industry is around the amount of time that's spent on the identification phase. So the ROV, the subsea visualizing of the targets, that's the most expensive. It's the longest. It's a little bit unpredictable in terms of how long it's going to actually physically take you, because you don't know how deep it's buried necessarily, and that type of time, that type duration that would take to investigate these targets. So our philosophy a little bit is around not so much focusing on identification, which is the end problem, but the actual root cause of it is the quality of the survey data that you produce. So your remote sensing type of technologies. And our kind of mantra within our team is it better survey for less identification. So making sure that we have a magnetometry sensor, for instance, or an acoustic sensor, or a combination of those that are optimized to give us the least amount of false positives, thereby meaning we have to do less identification at the end.
You're speaking about various survey sensors. Do you do a lot of collaboration with technology providers to access technology that you need?
Yeah, we do. A lot of it is in-house, and we have developed that over the years on our own and also with the external parties. We currently have a large series of R&D projects ongoing to do exactly that, and that involves both internal resources and external technology providers, component providers to the type of tools we're developing. So yeah, there is a lot of external and interaction beyond our own internal teams.
So in a world where remote operations are becoming more commonplace, and I guess specifically for the world of UXO, where there is a marked risk there and you'd want to avoid that, is it possible to do remote operations for your type of work?
Fugro has, as the industry will know, several remote operation centers globally around the world, and we're using that for operations, not just in UXO risk mitigation, but for ROV operations and anything where we feel that we can move crew from an offshore environment onshore. And that's something we pursue quite heavily with our UXO risk mitigation solution, as we believe there's a number of key benefits to having less people offshore, moving the experienced capacity into one room, and also allowing clients through the operation centers, remote operation centers dial-in, to access streaming video content that we're looking at live, in order to provide guidance and support for those operations. So, for instance, archaeology teams, for instance, look at something we may have found on the seabed, but also environmental considerations, and allow that to be assessed on the fly as the operations are happening without having to have people sit on vessels offshore. So, and I think that's very valid also in the COVID world we live in at the moment, that our remote operation centers play a big part in reducing the amount of exposure and the teams that we have to have offshore.
Can you describe for us, what are the key challenges that are facing the industry?
The key challenge, I mean, I think with any contractor is, you know, once we get to the point, or they get to a point that they understand that there is a UXO risk, is really trying to quantify and assess how great that risk is. And it's one of these difficult ones, because in the end, it's right up front of any development project. It's the starting point, and therefore it's in the critical path of any project development. So your milestone, your ability to deliver what I mentioned earlier, the ALARP certificate, is singularly the most important thing to your client. And the difficulty therein comes is until you actually conduct the work, you don't know how large the problem is, and therefore how long it's going to take, and how under threat that milestone is, and all the other contractors that are essentially waiting to undertake their phases of work in the development of, for instance, an offshore wind farm development. So it's the unknown, and not knowing the known before you actually start, that is the greatest difficulty and consideration that needs to be placed within the industry. We keep illustrating to our clients is start early, because you don't know what you're going to be dealing with. And there's been many projects around the world for all players in the industry where it was assessed to be a fairly quick process to undertake a survey. And then when the survey is done, you realize suddenly there's hundreds of targets that need to be investigated. And it puts project timelines and development milestones under severe threat.
Yes. And then you start feeling the pressure from being the critical path.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that we see that globally now is it's fairly developed in Europe in terms of the infrastructure, the framework under which you need to carry out the risk mitigation in a country in Europe, for instance. But once you go beyond that, it's something fairly new to a lot of these countries. And there isn't a clear path to where the responsibilities lie for that UXO risk mitigation process, what you can and can't do as a subcontractor or as an offshore wind farm developer. That adds another layer of complexity to actually dealing with this. We know how to deal with the situation when we and our clients know that we are responsible for it, but sometimes that isn't clear from the country. They don't have the legislation to back it up. There isn't a clear list of stakeholders and who has to sign off on the various aspects within that country, and that takes time to develop. So that is a key consideration and a constraint for any UXO risk mitigation project.
I was going to ask, do you get involved in advisory bodies or working on best practice to help improve sort of operations?
Yeah, we do. So we are involved in several bodies globally, and try to contribute to that and the understanding of the problem, the opportunities that also exist within that problem, and help guide the industry in a direction that makes this process constrained, controlled, and cost effective.
Is there anything that the SUT can do to assist in your job?
Yeah, I think so. I think as an organization, you have strong contacts within many organizations involved in the marine environment. And certainly the solutions and opportunities that those companies offer is something that the industry welcomes and needs. I think we're pushing the boundaries in many cases with UXO in terms of what we can do magnetometry, acoustics-wise, visualization-wise, machine learning-wise. And that's all good for underwater technologies in general, but it needs partnering between multiple role players to really get to a situation where those can be improved and solved effectively. When it comes to the process, and one of the constraints we see at the moment within the industry is a lot of these phases within the UXO risk mitigation process are currently contracted out to differing parties. So you'll have a party, for instance, doing the desktop historical study, another doing the survey, another doing the identification. When you end up in a situation where milestones are under threat and you need an effective risk mitigation campaign, we've seen all too often that combining that into a single source, a single contractor, definitely helps the process. It gives you the flexibility and the approach to mitigate that and make sure the milestones are hit. It leaves the control and the direction of hitting that milestone within one contractor. It makes the responsibilities clear, but also what it does, and linking back to the technology side of it, it allows the contractor then to invest in the R&D and the requirements around improving the solutions that we offer. It allows the opportunity for that, particularly through the offshore wind, for us to invest the time and effort and money into developing these solutions, if then the contractor has a real ability to drive the milestones and drive the delivery of those milestones for the UXO process.
It's really interesting, I mean, the whole process. And for the SUT membership and the wider audience, if they want to find out more or get in touch with you, how do they go about doing that?
Probably the easiest is simply to use uxo@fugro.com. That is a group email address that goes to the UXO team within Fugro. And depending on the nature of the question, the inquiry, there will be somebody within that grouping that will be able to assist and answer the questions or the additional information that's required.
Perfect. Thanks very much indeed. Thanks for taking the time to have a chat with us.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you'd like to learn more about SUT, you can go to sut.org. If you'd like to get in touch with us about appearing on a future podcast, or find out how you can sponsor an upcoming podcast, you can contact info@sut.org. Please don't forget to like, rate and subscribe, and we'll be back with a new episode next week.